to the December afternoon panel of the Court of Appeals. I'm Francie Riepen, and I'm pleased to be joined on my right with Chief Justice Frankie Moore from North Platte, and on my left from Larry Welch from Plattsmith. We have kind of a full docket today. I think we have six cases before us. It's really warm in here. So gentlemen and women as well, if you want to take off your jackets, you go right ahead. Our arguments today are live streamed and they are also recorded. So to the extent you have any confidential information, children's names, things of that nature, you might want to keep that in mind if you want to keep it confidential. And with that, I will call each case twice and counsel can approach at that point. So our first case of the day is Alberts versus Alberts. Alberts versus Alberts. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, Mr. Little and Mr. Johnson, my name is Heather Swanson Murray and I represent the appellant Joan Alberts in this matter. Even the most cursory review of the record in this case reflects that this was an acrimonious dissolution of marriage action, spanning as of the time of today's argument, 5.5 years.
And really a cursory review isn't possible with this record, is it?
It is not.
It's a large record.
It is a very large record. In that 5.5 years, the eldest child of the parties has reached the age of majority. As perhaps the most significant custody issues that were argued by Ms. Alberts dealt with the eldest child's custody and her special needs. Mm-hmm. And now that she has reached the age of 19, I would like to focus my argument today primarily on the property issues. And if I have time, I will address the remaining custody issue for the youngest minor child, and that is really a relatively minor issue as far as argument would go.
So just so I'm clear, so the oldest daughter, she's no longer an issue in this case.
Correct? That's correct. She has reached the age of 19.
And there was no provision to provide for her beyond the age of 19.
Correct.
Okay.
That
Thank
is
you.
Correct.
Thank you.
I trust that the court will give appropriate consideration to the remaining custody issues based on the information in each of the parties' briefs, even if they're not argued today. With respect to property issues, there are a number of errors that have been assigned by Ms. Alberts. Those errors include determination as to value of premarital property, inclusion of post-filing debt and a hypothetical debt, failure to give credit for debt paid by Ms. Alberts during the more than 1 year that this case was under advisement between trial and rendering of a decree of dissolution, and then the inequitable treatment of the parties by including credits or debts for one party and not the other. Ms. Alberts asserts that the trial court erred in its determination that Mr. Alberts' premarital property retained its premarital nature, or at the very least, in failing to find a greater portion of the property was marital property. The property in question is a quarter of farm ground that was owned by Mr. Alberts at the time of the marriage. The fact that Mr. Alberts owned the property prior to the marriage is not disputed. Also not disputed is the fact that there was debt against the property at the time of the marriage, and that at no time during the marriage and through the rendering of the decree of dissolution was that debt ever completely extinguished. All debt payments that were made on that particular property and on the debt had to have been made with marital funds because neither of the parties had any source of income other than joint income of the parties earned during the marriage. There are really three components to Ms. Alberts' argument with respect to the inappropriate valuation by the trial court of Mr. Alberts' premarital property. First is the appreciation of the ground as a result of improvements made by the parties, and that is in fact what appears to be the theory that the trial court used to assess some portion of the value of that property as marital property.
And that was based upon, I believe, the Gustafson appraisals?
It appears that way, yes. Yes. That doesn't address an equity argument that I believe can be made, which is the second component encompassing payment of debt with respect to that property during the marriage, in fact, over and over and over again, which Ms. Alberts argues should have been used to determine that the premarital portion of the ground had been used up or eclipsed by the payment of debt against the ground over the 20-year period of the party's marriage. Essentially, the argument comes down to that the premarital portion of the ground has lost its character by virtue of payment of indebtedness on the property over the 20-year marriage. If the court doesn't find that argument sufficient, then the third component is, in addition to the marital appreciation that the trial court found, credit for the premarital debt that existed at the time of the party's marriage. Mr. Alberts acknowledged that he had debt against the ground and against farm equipment and machinery that he owned at the time of the marriage that totaled $128,841. That debt was then rolled over into marital debt, and Mr. Alberts now walks away from the marriage having benefited by not having to now pay the $128,841 in premarital debt that he had at the time of the marriage. That is now debt that Ms. Alberts is liable for and has in fact been ordered to pay a portion of because it became marital debt. The trial court failed to give any consideration at all to that debt and the payment of that debt during the marriage, and in fact the trial court completely ignored the payment of that debt.
Was that addressed in the post-decree motions?
It was raised in the post-decree motions. The court declined to address that issue.
So, in other words, implicitly denied the request?
Yes.
The $128,841, that was the debt at the point in time they entered into the marriage?
Correct.
Did the amount of debt go down as they paid it off over the course of the marriage and then go back up as they borrowed additional? I mean, is the record clear with respect to that?
The record is not clear as to the amount. The record is clear that debt existed during the entire duration of the marriage, and at the time of the trial was over, I believe, over $400,000. So we don't have information in the record that shows exactly what happened to the debt or what the debt amounts were each and every year of the marriage, but both parties testified, as well as the party's banker testified, that there was no point in time that debt was completely paid off. These parties were never free and clear of that debt that existed at the time of the decree of dissolution that is the result of rolling over the premarital debt of Mr. Alberts.
And the 400 some thousand at the time of trial or whenever the valuations took place was just with regard to this quarter section?
No, it was with regard to all of the parties' properties. There were four quarter sections.
Right. So it's really hard to divide out and know what happened just regarding this particular quarter section, is there?
It is, yes, you're correct. That is difficult to determine, mm-hmm. which I think enhances the argument that that property has now become marital, because it's impossible to determine what debt may still exist with respect to that specific quarter, mm-hmm. and to determine whether there's any premarital character with respect to that particular property.
And do you have case law authority that tells us to focus on the debt aspect of premarital assets as opposed to the asset aspect?
The closest case that I could find is the Plog versus Plog case, which is cited in our brief. The citation is 20 Nebraska Court of Appeals 383, 824 Northwest 2nd, 749. It's a 2012 case. And in that case, it is at least somewhat factually similar to the situation in our current case. The court determined that payment of premarital debt and utilization of premarital property during the marriage, that utilization being marital in nature, converted essentially the premarital property to marital property. There are a few distinguishable factors present in the Plog case, but the main payments of the main principle of payment of debt and the use of that property to support the marital family during the marriage are consistent both in the Plog case and in our present case.
So would we kind of analogizing, we basically have to find that premarital property, if it's used to collateralize a marital debt, loses its premarital identity?
I don't know that you would have to go that far.
Right.
Because of the existence of the premarital debt, I think that makes it creates a distinguishable factor. If it was premarital property that had no debt against it at the time of the marriage and then was used to collateralize marital debt, I think that is a different situation than premarital property with significant premarital debt on it that is then rolled over into marital debt. Because now the parties during the marriage are paying the premarital debt, and instead of creating what should be marital equity, they're simply paying down the premarital portion of the debt that existed. So I think there is, I think those situations are distinguishable. The court further erred in including as a liability for Mr. Albert income tax liability that was tax liability hypothesized by his accountant that never materialized during the subsequent years that this case was pending. Mr. Alberts had an accountant testify that there should be $153,000 in income taxes owed as a result of 2013 grain sold in 2014. However, the court received both 2014. Would you like me to finish?
Just your thought, yes.
Okay, thank you. The court received 2014 and 2015 income tax returns because the case was pending so long, and that tax debt never materialized.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Richard Little of the law firm Ballew Hazen. I, along with my co-counsel, Joshua Johnson of the law firm Conway, Pauley & Johnson, represent the appellee, Mr. Thomas Rob Alberts, in this case. As the court is aware, this is a very extensive record, and it is a very complex case. As a preliminary matter, I would direct the court to the district court's initial decision, which was very detailed and thorough in its analysis, and we believe that the record supports the court's decision and should be affirmed in all respects.
Mr. Little, before you embark on your argument, would you agree that the issue of the eldest daughter is no longer before us?
Yes, we absolutely would agree.
Okay,
I would note that there is a guardianship in place with respect to the older daughter, which Mr. Alberts is the guardian.
Well, that's not in our record,
right.
But it's not relevant at this point.
Correct.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I think, Your Honors, the most important thing to keep in mind here is the standard of review in this case. In a marital dissolution case regarding custody, division of property, and classification as premarital property, the equitable division of that property, attorney fees, etc., the standard is de novo on the record for an abuse of discretion. And when we look at the issues raised by the appellant in this case, there simply is not sufficient evidence to show an abuse of discretion in any of the court's determinations. I'll address the issues that the appellant raises, starting with the classification of the premarital and post-filing property. The first thing I would direct the court to is that there is a general assignment of error with respect to the classification of this property, and we don't believe that that assignment of error is sufficient to seek the relief that the appellant is requesting in this case. 2017 Nebraska Supreme Court case Stevens v. Stevens stated that errors must be specifically assigned and argued to be considered. An assigned error on a premarital classification of appreciation in premarital corporation in that case, but the appellant failed to assign as error classification with respect to other specific assets. The Supreme Court declined to consider the other valuation issues. In this case, the appellant's assignment of error was that the trial court erred in determining and valuing what was premarital and post-filing property. Simply not specific enough to seek the relief that she is requesting.
Well, assuming it is, could you please address the issue of the premarital quarter section of real estate that appellant argues should have been characterized as marital?
Yes, Your Honor. So with respect to that property, there are four quarters that are involved, and that single premarital quarter is really the one that's at issue here. There's no dispute that my client owned it prior to the marriage. There's no dispute that that land had some debt to it and that he brought in some other property. The value of the land at that time is also undisputed that it was a dry ground at the time. During the marriage, it was improved to include irrigation. So that certainly alters its character a little bit. And how exactly that impacts your determination here is guided by the Stevens case that I previously mentioned. The ruling in the Supreme Court in that case is that the appreciation of non-marital assets during the marriage are presumed to be marital unless a party seeking the classification as premarital proves, one, that the growth was readily identifiable and traceable to a non-marital portion, and two, the growth was not due to active efforts by either spouse. The burden is on the owning spouse to prove that classification. The property can constitute a mixture. A portion of the asset can be marital and a portion non-marital. And oftentimes the original capital contribution is non-marital, and all or some of the earnings or appreciation may be classified as marital. Now, how does that apply in this instance? This premarital quarter was dry ground, as we indicated, and was converted to irrigated ground. We contend that the value of the dry ground before it was converted to irrigated is the premarital component. Now, Mr. Alberts had the burden to prove that. He had an appraiser that went through and analyzed the value of that land, both as it were to be dry ground and as irrigated ground. The court relied on that appraisal in looking at the difference, and that difference was the active appreciation and the value that was brought forward by the irrigated ground. That was correctly set aside as part of the marital estate, and the remaining portion was passive appreciation due to an increase in the value of the dry ground. Now, once Mr. Alberts provided that information, the burden shifts to the appellant here to demonstrate or provide counter evidence that that value is incorrect or that that value should be included in its entirety, and she failed to do so. At nowhere.
What as to her argument, though, that the court did nothing with respect to the $128,000 in debt that was attached to that property when he originally brought it into the marriage? Is that accounted for?
It is, Your Honor, but I would clarify that the debt at the time that the land was brought into the marriage was only $39,000, not $128,000. In addition, Mr. Alberts also brought in some liquid assets, cash, crops, etc., as well as premarital machinery. Now, there was some discussion as to the treatment of that debt, and the appellant recommends the court to look at Plog v. Plog. That is incorrect for two reasons. Number one, Plog v. Plog has been expressly abrogated by Stevens in terms of how it is treating the classification of premarital property. But more importantly, there's a more recent case by the Supreme Court that is much more on point in Ostentowski v. Ostentowski, 2017 case, which involved the treatment of premarital crops and how payment of premarital debts should be factored into it. The important distinction that we learned from the Ostentowski case is that in that instance, the farmer had premarital debts, premarital assets in the form of crops, and there was a set-aside for the value of those crops, and thus the value of that debt should be included. Ergo, in this case, there was no set-aside for Mr. Albert's premarital value of the machinery or the liquid assets that he brought into the marriage, which the value of those combined more than offset the value of the debt that was brought in at that time. Furthermore, there was no commingling, as the appellant would argue here. Specifically, the existence of the debt really is irrelevant. She admits it was never paid off, and even if it was, the debt at the time was minimal compared to the value that he brought in at that time. Furthermore, the entirety of the marital debt on the ground was assigned to Mr. Alberts. So whether or not it was included or not, it really becomes irrelevant, and it didn't convert the nature of the asset itself. And that's really what the Ostentowski case indicates, that the debt and the asset are treated separately if they are analyzed separately, as they were in this case.
This is going a different direction here, but it reminds me that the entire debt for all of the real estate was assigned to your client, which is contrary, as I understand it, to the bidding agreement.
Yes, it was.
And I believe that was raised again in the post-decree motions, but the court didn't correct it. What's your client's position on that today?
Well, certainly, he wasn't a big fan of having that large amount of debt assigned to him. They had agreed to split it based on the quarters that were awarded on their bidding agreement. However, the court recognized that the acrimonious nature of these parties, the communication issues that they've had, presented a certain difficulty in trying to have two individuals that are trying to get separated for 5 years, both on the same debt. The court didn't have the ability to force the bank to split the debt and refinance it. And the court looked at this and decided there's a $5.7 million estate. Each person is receiving at least $1.5 million in assets. They both had the ability to pay the debt. Did he like it? No. But was he able to handle it? Absolutely. Now, it's not in the record, but I would note that the debt has been paid off and the property judgment's been satisfied. So to the extent that it's an issue here, it's really becoming moot at this point because everybody's resolved that particular issue. And there's an acceptance of the benefits of that respect that may be an issue here as well. Turning to the additional arguments as to the treatment of other premarital assets, the court looked at this from an equitable standpoint. There is adequate evidence in the record as to each of the issues that were raised by the appellant in her brief and oral argument as to the treatment of that property, from the equipment, which was set aside to him. There was no value assigned. And under Brozek, the setting aside of property is easy where that property still exists. That happened here.
Can you address quickly the income tax liability issue?
Absolutely. It's interesting that the appellant raises that issue particularly because the income tax liability was really incurred because of actions by the appellant. At the point in time in 2013...
Well, I think the question is whether it really is incurred.
Right. The debt was incurred in that my client had to sell off crops earlier than anticipated, incurring a debt, and offsetting that through purchasing of pre-purchasing expenses, etc. So the exact dollar value wasn't later attributed per se. However, the court has the authority to equitably determine the value of those crops. It factored in the tax implications of that. May not have been the exact amount that was incurred in the tax, but that was money that he had to spend on prepaid expenses and other things to try and reduce his overall tax liability. Actions that would not have been necessary but for the appellant's specific bad act of withdrawing $180,000 from the corporate account, which she was not authorized to do, in which she pled the Fifth Amendment to not incriminate herself when confronted with that issue during trial. May I take a brief moment to conclude?
You may.
For the above reasons, we would ask that the court please affirm the district court's decision in all respects, find that the property division and classification was equitable and appropriate under the facts of the case, as well as the custody and other issues that were raised in the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe the appellant is out of time. Okay. Case is submitted. Counsel, you're excused. Thank you.